This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday. But first, Dr. Dina Grayson is on the line with us. She is a physician and an MD. She's a biochemist, a PhD, and a former Democratic candidate for Florida's 9th District in the U.S. House of Representatives. Dina Grayson, D-E-N-A, Grayson, G-R-A-Y-S-O-N, .com, like as in Alan, is her website. And her Twitter handle is Dr. Dina Grayson, D-R Dina Grayson. Dr. Grayson, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
So I was watching TV, and Alan Cohen was testifying, and I'm looking over his shoulder, and I see this woman sitting in the back row, and I said to Louise, she looks awful familiar. Is that Dina Gray? Was that you?
That was me, sitting right over Michael Cohen's left shoulder.
Yeah, yeah. So what? You know, as somebody who is not just a smart person, but also, you know, very engaged in Democratic Party politics, what was your sense of what happened in that room that we might not have gotten from watching it on TV? What did we miss?
Well, I think that one of the reasons I went to the hearing really was there were two main reasons. Number one is, just as you said, Tom, it's really different when you're in the room. You get the vibe. You can actually watch the lawmakers as they're questioning the witness, as well as I actually interacted with Mr. Cohen's entourage, including his attorney. But I also wanted to represent all of us in that room. I felt that this was a historic hearing. You know, I think that there were moments that were truly poignant. You know, I think that Mr. Cohen came across as extremely, I think, credible and sincere. And there were parts where, you know, I was sitting behind him and I could tell that he was weeping. Hmm. And I could tell by the expressions on the lawmakers' faces that his testimony and certain aspects of it was moving to him. And yeah. I actually spoke with some of the members afterward about that.
Well, and I saw that in the wrap-up. That was when it was most clear to me that was you sitting behind him, and you were nodding your head along with him as he was responding in some way, as he was making his closing statements, and then, you know, when Congressman Elijah Cummings was speaking, and it nearly brought me to tears. What were the, one of the things we rarely saw were the faces of the Republicans in the room, unless they happened to be on camera because they were speaking. How were they dealing with this? I mean, they're all there trying to defend a clearly criminal president, or a president who's engaged in criminal acts, shall we say, has not yet been convicted. And here were these allegations of criminality, and really they didn't even want to go near this. How were they reacting? What were you seeing there?
Well, with the exception of Justin Amash, and Justin Amash is a Republican who's kind of known for swimming upstream, so I give him a ton of credit for that.
Yeah.
With that one exception, you know, what was really pathetic is that we have this hearing that literally is probably the most important hearing that any of these lawmakers have ever attended or participated in their entire careers. And the vast majority of them yielded back their time to the chair, meaning they just didn't even want to ask questions. I mean, that's just pathetic and ridiculous. So really what we saw was the complicit Republican Party, delay, obfuscation, distraction, deflection. I mean, one guy was talking about MS-13 and infrastructure.
Oh, my God.
Nothing to do with Michael Cohen. Right. I couldn't help but roll my eyes. I swear I thought they were going to roll out of my head. So that was the typical Republican Party. But I think that speaks volumes, Tom, because they ain't got nothing. I mean, really. I mean, what they should have done was tried to discredit him, but they really struggled because guess what? Cohen brought receipts. He had receipts.
Yeah.
And because of his demeanor of being, he really was, and, you know, a lot of criminal prosecutors have discussed this. He showed remorse. He accepted the responsibility for his crimes. I mean, you know, he was part of the Trump crime family for a very long time.
Yes.
So he's a felon. And yeah. He readily admitted it, and he expressed regret. and remorse and shame. And, you know, I spoke with Mr. Cummings, Chairman Cummings, after the hearing for quite a while. And, you know, the word that we both said was redemption. And I think that that was really what Mr. Cullen was going for. And I think he got it. And I think that the Republicans saw that. I think, you know, they really did a very poor job. But then again, there is no defense for Donald Trump.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think everybody watching TV got that. And that's why I was curious to ask you, what were the things that we missed? And so my last question has to do with Matt Gaetz, G-A-E-T-Z, this guy who tweeted, this Republican congressman, is he from Florida? Am I remembering that?
Oh, goodness, yes, he is.
Yeah, okay, that was my recollection.
Staying on our state.
Yeah, and you know, he tweeted the day before the testimony or 2 days before the testimony to Michael Cohen, right, saying that his wife wouldn't be faithful to him while he's in prison and basically threatening him. He had to walk that back because Nancy Pelosi, I think, threatened him with an ethics inquiry, which apparently is happening anyway. The Florida bar is now looking into whether they should even pull his law license. But this guy is like, I mean, that was like the kind of thing that you would expect out of the Genovese crime family, the remaining patriarch of which, by the way, day before yesterday or yesterday, made a comment to a reporter that he thinks that Cohen will not survive going to prison, because he said the people in prison love Trump and they're, you know, the white supremacists in prison. One of the major, you know, the major gang among white people in prison are these various white supremacist groups, and they will take him down, which is a chilling thought. But I understand that Mr. Gaetz, Congressman Gaetz, was in the room and was positioning himself so that Michael Cohen could see him, so that he could basically, you know, stare at Cohen and threaten him. That's what I read, but I wasn't in the room. You were. Is that what happened?
Tom, that is 1,000% what happened. And in fact, I took, you know, I did take a picture of him. You're not really kind of supposed to, but I couldn't help it. I was stunned. He, you know, first of all, this guy, Matt Gaetz, he's not even on the committee.
Right.
So, and he shows up. I mean, like, shouldn't he be doing his job? So he shows up to this committee hearing the day after this threatening tweet, which frankly was witness intimidation or witness tampering, which is a felony. And Congresswoman Plaskett actually recommended that he be investigated criminally, and I fully agree with that. And he was staring down Cohen. I have a picture of it. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
He was literally staring him down with his arms crossed, and in particular, it was during the time that Michael Cohen was testifying about the bombshell phone call between Roger Stone and Donald Trump, where Roger Stone was telling Mr. Trump about this phone call with Julian Assange, and that WikiLeaks was going to dump the emails that had been stolen by Russia. I mean, total collusion here.
Yeah.
Smoking gun, and he was staring down Cohen. It was unbelievable.
It's incredible.
It was out of the Godfather.
Yeah,
literally.
And apparently,
like
while Trump was flying back from North Korea or sometime around there, Trump used the equipment of, you know, all that super high tech stuff on Air Force One to be able to call anybody anywhere, and according to several people who overheard the conversation, he called Congressman Gaetz and thanked him for going after Cohen like that.
Well, I mean, look, you know, Trump, the Trump family, their business model has been to launder money for the mob for decades.
Yeah.
Trump's father laundered money for the Italian mob, and his son Donald has been laundering money for the Russian mob for a very long time, as the American public is going to hear when Felix Sater, who is a convicted Russian mobster and has been an FBI informant for decades, he's going to testify openly in front of the House Intelligence Committee
right,
in the middle of the month, on March 14th.
Yeah.
And look, not only did he have an office in Trump Tower, this mobster, Felix Sater, his office was on the same floor as Trump's and became Michael Cohen's office. I mean, I did not know that. I learned that from Mr. Cohen during the hearing, which was just stunning. And, you know, look, Felix Sater has been laundering money into the country for the Russian mob for a long time and laundering it through Trump property. This is the business model.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Dr. Dina Grayson, her website, dinagrayson.com. You can tweet her at Dr. Dina Grayson, MD, PhD. Dr. Grayson, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
My pleasure. Great talking with you. We'll be back. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls right after this. And welcome back. Karen in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Karen, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just watching you talk to Dina Grayson, Dr. Grayson, about the Cohen trial. I found it unwatchable because the people were testifying, not Cohen testifying. But when you were introducing her, I was hoping that she was at the big pharmaceutical trial testifying, because I didn't get to see very much of that, and that's why I was calling.
Ron Wyden really did the heavy lifting there, and he's got, I've received a couple of emails from his, just because I'm a constituent, right? I live in Oregon. And I've gotten a couple of emails from him about it, and I'm guessing that at wyden.senate.gov, you'll find a lot of information about that hearing. I haven't looked, but I would be astonished if it wasn't there.
Well, you know, one of the things that they're really not talking about very much is the fact that most of our drugs are being manufactured overseas.
Yeah, in India and China, yes.
India, China, and Ireland. You know, I see my pill bottles, and they're coming from all over. And these are generic drugs, but I'm still paying so much. And even the generics are being, the costs are going up year over year, even for the generics.
Yep.
And yet these big pharmaceutical companies are still trying to justify these increases while they still make billions.
Oh, they're running a massive ad campaign right now trying to get people to call their members of Congress to prevent the government, prevent Medicare from being able to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry the way that the Veterans Administration does and Medicaid does. They don't want Medicare to negotiate prices with them. They want Medicare to be forced by law to pay for the full retail price. So the one pill full retail price is what Medicare pays, even if they buy a million pills of a particular drug every year. It's insane.
I have to say, one other thing that bothers me about what they're trying to go around doing with that is they're trying to get permission for people to buy their drugs from other countries. And I don't think that's a good way for us to go about handling the situation. We shouldn't be trying to find ways for us.
I've looked at this. There's a medication I take for blood pressure and have for a couple of years. Not a big deal, and I take a very, very low dose of it. But it's amazing. The cost of that drug has gone from $15 a prescription to over $130 a prescription in the last 4 years, the last 4 or 5 years. And I looked into a Canadian pharmacy, and it's the exact same drug. And by the way, it's manufactured in Hyderabad, India. No matter where you buy it, no matter what country you buy it in, it's one of the big pharmaceutical companies. It's manufactured in India. And if I buy that exact same drug from Canada, it costs me about $20. If I buy it here in the United States, it's $143.
So, one of the other things that concerns me about these drugs being manufactured overseas is the oversight.
Yeah.
We don't have our FDA going in and
well, and there are three of these, the sartan family of blood pressure medications that have been pulled from the market recently. In fact, there's a shortage of some of them, which is not why the price of mine is going up, but because they're contaminated by rocket fuel. Which causes cancer. They have a cancer-causing contamination that came obviously out of the water supply from wherever they're being manufactured, and it must be that, you know, someplace around there's some industrial process that's using either rocket fuel or some ingredient in rocket fuel that is this, you know, one of these things that very rapidly contaminates underwater aquifers. And it's just, the whole thing is just bizarre. It's all about the money. It's not about what's best for the American people. It's not about, you know, what's best. It's just about the money. Welcome back. Kenyatta in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You had a caller that a while back, and there was some discussion about North Korea. And in your response, you had mentioned that Kim Jong-un had pretty much gotten what he wanted in terms of being on the world stage, and basically publicity. And you said, you made the statement equal to the United States.
Yeah. Well, not as a country, but as a, you know, leader to leader, that he is perceived, particularly by the dictators of the world. Here's how you get to be as high status as Donald Trump is. Essentially, that's what he's trying to say.
I wanted to pick your brain on this a little bit.
Go for it.
Now, because as a country equal to the United States, then, you know, I think you would agree that we are all the sum total of our life experiences, and we see life through that lens. Is that, would you agree with that?
Sure.
Okay, I see life through the lens of a black male in this country, and I've always heard the word for half a century, equality, being equal. I still hear it. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, who decides what is it and what's equal, and equal to whom? For instance, let's take North Korea and the United States. Equal, would it be in illiteracy, which we rank in the lowest of the industrialized nations in? Would it be in mass shootings, which we are number one in? Would it be in gun deaths, infant mortality, geopolitical adventurism, voter fraud? Who decides what's equal, Tom?
Well, what I was trying to say is that there is an equivalence. The reason why Barack Obama would not meet with Kim or most other dictators in the world, and frankly, neither would George W. Bush, and neither would have his father, neither would have Ronald Reagan with Kim's father and grandfather. No president would have met face to face with the Korean dictator, is because you are elevating them while you are lowering yourself by suggesting that there is an equivalence, essentially a status equivalence, between the president of the United States and the dictator of North Korea. That's what I was trying to say, Kenyatta. With regard to who gets to decide, I mean, God only knows.
Yeah, no, I understand that, Tom. And you're a man that, as you know, I have great respect for. That's why I'm asking the question. But I think we can agree that were it not for his nuclear weapons, none of this would be happening. And you have
sure.
to understand that's the lens he's looking at it through.
Oh, yeah. And that's why Kim's never going to give up his nukes. I mean, what Donald Trump said by meeting with Kim, the message that Donald Trump communicated to, Musharraf or whatever his name is, the guy who's running Pakistan, which is nuclear armed, is don't ever give up your nuclear weapons. You will only be taken seriously if you're nuclear armed. The message that he communicated to Mohammed bin Salman, the dictator of Saudi Arabia, was you better get some nuclear weapons. In fact, the message he communicated to every single tin pot dictator, you know, whether it's Kazakhstan or whether it's, pick your country, right? Countries that you've never heard of. Every single tin pot dictator in the world now knows that at least as long as Donald Trump is president, if they want to be taken seriously on the world stage, if they want to get bennies, if they want to, I mean, you know, Trump just, they just announced, and I haven't heard all the details, but I saw the Chyron on the news just a few minutes ago, breaking news, Trump is killing off the South Korean, U.S. annual joint exercises, which he already postponed, you know, last year as a consequence of the Singapore meeting. And so, if you want the United States not only to recognize you, not only to acknowledge you, not only to elevate you on the world stage and tell everybody how wonderful you are, even if you murder journalists or even if you murder American citizens who stole a poster in a hotel, which is what Otto Warmbier did. He took a poster with a picture of Kim off the wall and stuck it in his suitcase. That's what they killed him for. That if you do that and you have nuclear weapons, Donald Trump will suck up to you. It's bizarre.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's some interesting days ahead.
Yes, yes. And I would submit to you, Kenyatta, that this is not just a breach of protocol. This is not just a stupid mistake. This is not just bad foreign policy. This is insane foreign policy. This is one of the worst things that a president of the United States could ever do because of its impact on all these smaller countries, particularly the kleptocracies where, you know, now all you need is a small nuclear power plant or even a nuclear reactor that was designed for medical purposes, which are ubiquitous. I mean, they're all over the world. All you need is, you know, if you can enrich that uranium, you are in fat city. And it is just so wrong. Kenyatta, thank you for the call. Always nice to hear from you. We'll be right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour, and anything goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Back with more of your calls in just a second. Stick around. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Kamal in Chicago. Am I saying your name right?
You're talking to me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, I'm Kamal.
Kamal. Hey, what's up? You're on the air.
Yeah, long-time listener. Love your show. And I think I might have misheard you, or maybe I'm also going off of the last caller, Kenyatta, who was mentioning about North Korea.
Okay.
And something to the effect that... maybe not having those exercises off the coast of North Korea, with South Korea is not a good idea to cancel those.
We are at war with North Korea. We have been at war with North Korea since, what, 1949, 1950?
Right.
And there's never been a peace treaty signed, and until a peace treaty is signed, the country which has declared repeatedly its intention to use its million-man army and its guns, which are right now aimed at Seoul. I mean, the DMZ is close enough to Seoul that they could, just at a whim of Kim, kill millions of people. And they repeatedly threatened to do this. And South Korea is not only a strategic ally, but also a fully developed democracy. For us to say to Kim, we are no longer going to basically take this annual defensive posture. I'm not a big fan of military exercises in general, and I'm not a big fan of a bloated military budget. And I think you probably know that if you've listened to the program very long. In fact, I think our military budget is probably more than twice of what is necessary, maybe even four times what is necessary for a country our size and for what we do. But all that said, when you've got that kind of a situation, And you know, really, I just don't see why Trump would give that away. If the Pentagon comes forward and says, you know, we really don't need to do this every year, we can do it every 3 years. I mean, this is really like basically teaching our pilots to coordinate with South Korean pilots so that if we end up at war with North Korea, we're not flying into each other over the skies, right? Because we've got a treaty with South Korea, and we are literally at war with North Korea. And Donald Trump, during a time of war, went over and gave aid and comfort to our enemy. That, according to my read of the Constitution, is treason. And then he came back and he said to the military, and by the way, let's not make this guy feel insecure anymore. I want him to feel very insecure. What am I missing, Kamala? What's your disagreement with what I'm saying?
So, yeah, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and I had believed the same for the longest time as well. But given that, that the South Korean leader himself wants to have these talks, and also given the history of the United States of America, how we decimated North Korea, we leveled that country in 1953 or something like that. For us, I believe the American empire, if you recall it, is going down and isn't as strong as it used to be. And we should be trying to wind down the nuclear weapons in the world, even just a little bit.
Yeah, as the UK did. I mean, the UK was once a worldwide empire, and now they're not. And, a colonial power, and now they're not. And we, in my opinion, we should not be a worldwide empire or a colonial power. But that does not mean that we don't have strategic and political interests around the world that, at least at the moment, we should defend. If you've got a outside of the relative abstraction of winding down American empire, and you know, out of we have 730 some odd military bases around the world. There's a lot of them that could be unwound, right? And, a lot of places where we can cut back on our military spending, all that kind of stuff. Totally with you on all that. But specific to this, I don't get it.
But it's not just that. It's a nuclear weapons thing. I mean, for us, we tell North Korea, hey, we'll lift some sanctions off of you. why can't we say, hey, whatever nuclear weapons you have, and then we say this to Israel, we say this to any of our adversaries, like Russia, for example, we will take off our nuclear weapons, too. But that's never the discussion.
We haven't reduced our nuclear arsenal simply because Israel has created nuclear weapons, and the reductions in nuclear weapons between the United States and Russia were, carefully negotiated over a long period of time, over several presidencies. This was principally Reagan, Bush, and Clinton.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that this is an extremely rare opportunity with North Korea. We may never have this discussion again.
Oh, yeah, and we sent an incompetent con man, mobbed up New York real estate guy in to do the deal, and he failed to do any prep at all. This was, Kamal, thank you for the call. I mean, this is like stupid 101, right? When you are doing international relations with other countries, when you're president of the United States and you're doing, and you are conducting foreign policy out in the open, you first conduct foreign policy behind closed doors. You get together with that country, you say, here's what we want, what do you want? They say, here's what we want, what do you want? And you say, okay, here's what I'm willing to get. You work it out, you get to the point where, okay, we can agree on these things, on these principles, and we can sell these to our people and the rest of the world. And then you bring in the presidents to sit down and have a handshake and sign the documents. There's no way that Trump and Kim can sit down in 2 days or, functionally 5 or 6 hours at the most and hammer out a nuclear nonproliferation treaty. I mean, it's just impossible. But Donald Trump is like all about stagecraft. He's all about being a reality TV star, and he doesn't understand governance. All he's ever done his entire life, he inherited a fortune from his daddy. It would be a much larger fortune right now. He'd be worth well over $10 billion if he had simply taken the $400 or $500 million that he inherited and stole, essentially, through tax frauds and things, from his father's estate and put it into the Dow, right? He'd be worth tens of billions of dollars right now, or at least $10 billion. He's probably not even worth $1 billion right now. In fact, David Kane Johnston is saying, his income last year was less than half a million dollars. I mean, the guy's actually broke, according to some people. I mean, who knows? But that's the guy we sent in to do this? I'm speechless. Tarek in Griffin, Georgia. Hey, Tarek, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, it's been a lot of loom and gloom, but I come to bring a little bit of hope. I was just talking to the woman that put me on about how I see how the symbolism in, the MAGA hats and the wall. And I think that's really, I don't really think that's just deep racism. I think that's deep economic, despair. I was just in an Uber. I was just with an Uber driver, and I was, letting them know how, 80% of Americans, live in, check to check. And
yeah.
So, but I think what can bring both sides together, the Bernie Sanders supporters and the Trump supporters is Bernie Sanders. And I think that's what I'm really hopeful about Bernie Sanders with the record numbers of money he's been able to raise with more than a million supporters. Then the Green New Deal. I'm really hopeful about what can happen. But, I think we just have to pay attention to, CNN, they just hired, a right winger for editorial control at CNN, and it's just
for their election coverage. Yeah, a Republican strategist and an operative
right.
Who's going to be running CNN's
right.
Election coverage, right? For the next year and a half. Which is obscene, for lack of a better word. But Tarek, I think that your larger point, that economic insecurity makes people vulnerable in a whole variety of ways,
including
vulnerable to the poison of racism, is absolutely true.
And I hope people know that if you want a well-paying job, even if African Americans even want a hint at a chance at getting reparations, I think Bernie Sanders is the catalyst for which everybody, will see a greener side,
I agree. That Bernie can do it. Tarek, you know, I've got to move along because I just have 1 minute until I'm going to hit a break here. But I agree with your point. I would add, though, that I think that's also true of Elizabeth Warren, and that may well be true of a number of other candidates. So we'll just have to see how it shakes out. But your point is well made. Tarek, thanks for the call. David in San Pedro, you've got the minute before the break here before we head into talk media news. What's up?
I got a copy of Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight in the last fundraiser and was reading it, and I've kind of developed a theory that all the billionaires are rigging the system so that they can have all their walled estates and survive the environmental collapse that may be coming.
I don't know if I put it in the book or not, but we've talked about it on this program. A number of the abandoned missile silos in the central parts of the United States and the West have been bought up by real estate developers who have turned them into multi-million dollar, I mean, you know, like $10, $20 million underground, almost cities, you know, with their own air filtration systems, their own electric systems, their own ability to grow food, you know, doomsday places for billionaires. And it's a hot market, and they're being bought up as fast as they can be built.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think you're onto something.
But get any traction as a political argument, though, to accuse them of
no,
that?
I think it's a sad commentary on the state of affairs. But I'm, you know, should anybody have that kind of money? But I don't know about the politics of it. David, thank you for the call, and thanks for reading Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. It's one of the favorite books that I've written. Somebody noted the other day that the brand new edition that's up on Amazon is still listed as 2004, but it's the new edition.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
We spent the last 2 years, in fact, updating that and bringing all the science up to date and everything else in the Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. We'll be right back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. And welcome back. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Well, hello there, Fred. Happy top of the morning to you there.
Thank you. Back at you.
You betcha. I want to speak to the drug prices here, but I just a quick comment about, you know, the shameful, it's just shameful how the Manchurian candidate's enforcer Getz at Cohen's hearing was allowed to, the other day, was allowed to stare.
Congressman Matt Getz, yeah.
Yeah, intimidate, you know, Cohen there. And also those tweeting out, you know, his tweets of threats and stuff. And,
right,
and I really hope
for your wife, yeah.
You know, I hope it's looked into. Anyways, Tom, you know, these RXs, you know, I pay almost $600, you know, for a 3-month supply of Advair Diskus for asthma.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is pretty outrageous. And I've come to the conclusion that the American people, you know, we've just become nothing more than, by and large, an ATM that dispenses tax-free money, basically, to what I'll say, I'll call these people drugsters.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. I mean, I'm spending $100 a month on a drug that I'm quite confident the cost of producing that drug is less than 3 or 4 cents a pill. And
can I ask you, are you on like an ACE inhibitor or a calcium channel blocker or a beta blocker?
The drug is Candesartan. It's a it's an angiotensin II inhibitor.
Yeah, I'm on lisinopril of that, but
I'm taking a very super low dose. You know, I mostly control my blood pressure, have my entire life with diet, but both my father and my grandmother had extremely high blood pressure. It is, it's genetic, I guess.
It's not good. I'm glad it's, you know, you're getting it controlled. Well, anyways, Tom, have a nice weekend, and best to everybody there.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Have a great one. Paul in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Called about realpolitik, the lay of the land. Want to talk about the three big dictators playing the realpolitik game, Netanyahu, Putin, and Trump. And in the old Perry Mason series from 50 years ago, there was a triangle of Della, Perry, and Paul. And Della loved Perry and the power that Perry could access. Paul loved Della for her class and, you know, what Putin loves the Russian models about, and Perry loves Paul, whether it was actuated romance, or just the fact that he was a man of action and Perry was sitting.
Yeah, we're dating ourselves here, Paul. Yeah. I would, by the way, disagree that Netanyahu is a dictator. He is in a democratic society, and in all probability is going to be voted. Well, we'll see whether he gets voted out of office, and he may be prosecuted. Putin and Trump, yeah, you know, while Trump, I mean, America's supposedly a democracy, although he lost the election by 3 million votes. So, but anyhow, you want to summarize your point here in 30 seconds?
And that's why Netanyahu loves Trump, is Trump has surfed those technicalities to his position, staying one step ahead of the law. Now Netanyahu's been indicted.
Yeah. He hasn't yet been indicted. Putin. The prosecutor says he could indict him.
Yes, yes. So Netanyahu loves Trump for that, and Trump loves Putin because he wants to be able to put polonium-210 in any of his enemies, crud, a wink of his eye.
Yep.
And then Putin wants the cultural solidarity of the Jewish state of Netanyahu.
I don't know about that. I think Putin wants Russia to be respected in the world, on the world stage. I really think that that's his principal motivating factor. But anyhow, we'll be right back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. Talk Media News up next. So welcome back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. On the line with us is, this report, by the way, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. On the line with us is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, Luke Vargas, joins us today from UN headquarters in New York. You can hear his 2-minute-a-day news podcast, basically, wherever you get your podcasts. Luke, it's been a day and a half since 36 hours, more or less, since the talks with Kim broke down. What's going on here? It looks to me like this was just an absolute failure of preparation. I don't think any president in my lifetime, literally, has walked into a high-profile public meeting with the head of state of another country with the explicit stated public goal of signing an agreement without having first had his people negotiate it.
Yeah, and the bit about preparation was underscored a few days ago. I forget exactly what it was, but I was on a press conference call with the White House, where an official I can't name was talking about how Trump was dedicating himself, 24 hours a day to being as prepared as he could be for this summit.
And then he was watching lots and lots of Fox News and hoping that they would talk about Korea.
and not 10 minutes later, I forget what he was talking about, but he was like ranting about basically the NFL or Bob Kraft or something. And it's just like, really now? So clearly I think preparation is an issue. It's kind of interesting. I would say, while I think your sort of takeaway here, that preparation is at the heart of the problem, is a pretty, popular sentiment here. There are, experts are sort of identifying different things here that could have been at the root. So I'll just go over a few of the main theories here. I mean, one that's coming from folks like 38 North, the think tank, is that, we are seeing confirmation, in their words, that Trump is relying on the madman theory of negotiations, which was first used by Richard Nixon with respect to the Chinese, the sort of thinking there being that you aim to portray to your adversary or your negotiating partner here that you are so volatile that, the president's emotions can't be constrained on an issue, and that because of how volatile the U.S. president's reaction could be, North Korea is going to basically beg for peace, and that Trump was sort of giving off these impressions deliberately in advance that he was about to bargain away everything, and then he comes there and just sort of goes.
Well, Luke, if I may, that the whole madman theory was basically a Republican con job story put together to justify Richard Nixon stretching the war over a political election in order to get elected as a wartime president. I mean, there was no actual strategy to that effect.
Yeah, and I will say, a lot of the people who are on conservative talk radio that I've been speaking to are pretty inclined to reach for this because it would sort of explain Trump's erratic tendencies.
Maybe he's just a madman.
Like he's a mad genius. Right. Where's the difference between madman and mad genius? So anyways, that's one sort of theory here. I mean, I guess some things I've observed is that I think it's pretty clear that the North Korean side underestimates our negotiating capabilities here, that they, you know, after so many months of us asking politely or whatever it is for an inventory of their nuclear facilities and their weapons that they never even engaged on, that when it sort of seemed like, as we're told, the negotiations in Hanoi were focusing in on this Yongbyon nuclear reactor and possibly steps that North Korea could take to shut it down in order to get various sanctions relief, when we evidently started pushing them for details about sort of how they would shut it down, which parts of the facility they would be willing to give up, they apparently stonewalled and said, you know, we haven't thought it through that much, which suggests that, you know, they might have thought, and this would be pretty concerning, that we just need to mention a facility like this, and that will be enough for the U.S. to start engaging with us. Now, it's, you know, again, it's sort of problematic that they didn't prepare on that front, and they probably know what it would look like to actually take this facility apart. But to me, that signals that they underestimated us and that, you know, they could sort of name drop this facility.
I think that that's an indication of something very different. Donald Trump is backing away right now. We just had the largest trade deficit in the history of the United States, and the year before was just about as bad. And Trump claims that he's going to reduce the trade deficit by his tariffs against China. China has backed him up to the wall, and Trump is now saying that, well, he actually postponed, you know, the increase in tariffs. And so I think that what Kim is seeing is that Trump will back down, and if you pressure him, and he figured that the pressure of the glare of public publicity, he figured that Trump is more, and the same thing with Mexico. You look at the new NAFTA, right? It's essentially just as it's identical to the old NAFTA with a little cosmetic changes. That Trump actually isn't interested in the details of the deal. He just wants the photo opportunity. That's what Kim believed. And there's you know, those are two examples of actually when that happened, where you know that there's proof of that. And I think that's just a reasonable and rational thing for Kim to think.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the clock here, but I'll just sort of say as a final note to close this out that, I mean, if you're in North Korea and you're thinking, you know, we were being threatened 18 months ago, whatever it was, with war and destruction, decapitation, as Trump would say, and we decided to get into a process, and all we have to do is hold one summit a year for maybe 3 years, and we've waited out Trump, and in the process undermined the international sanctions regime against us, gotten Russia and China to partner up, we're kind of in the end game now, and Trump's time managing this process will run out, and Kim will be the beneficiary of that. I think.
Oh, not just Kim.
Unfair to say. We might not get a third, fourth, certainly not a fifth summit at this point.
The real friggin' disaster here, Luke, is that right now every dictator in the world who has the resources of Kim is trying to build a nuclear bomb. That's
in my opinion.
That's the crisis. Thank you. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.